Hey all, this is Bert coming to you Baywide. That song's by them Eastport Oyster Boys called SAV Tango. And if that's not a big enough hint on today's topics, well, let's roll right into the headline. That's right, this is Baywide, a show all about the Chesapeake Bay. Today's headline comes to us from the Washington Post. But if you are one of the 37 people that listened to my very first episode, you will not be surprised by this headline at all. In fact, I'm just going to come right out and say it. I said this way before the Washington Post did. They are already stealing my journalism. It's all right. I forgive them because they're getting the word out there. But today's headline is Why the Chesapeake Bay is the Best in the World. Yeah, I know. Sounds eerily similar to my very first episode. I know. So this article is written by the editorial board of the Washington Post, and it's mainly referencing a peer-reviewed study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the United States of America. But I'm just going to call them PENIS for short, because these jerkopotamuses won't even let you read the entire text of the study without paying a subscription, which is really a bummer because the average person just doesn't have direct access to peer-reviewed research papers. The name of the paper is Long-Term Nutrient Reductions Lead to the Unprecedented Recovery of a Temperate Coastal Region. The Washington Post article is labeled an opinion article, but it's not an opinion, it's just straight up fact that the Chesapeake Bay is the best in the world. Yeah, and I'm looking at you, San Francisco Bay. I'm always going to call you out. Y'all suck. So this article is referencing the resurgence of bay grasses, or if you're a scientist, you call them SAVs, submerged aquatic vegetation. And they've truly rebounded. Let's talk about maybe why. About 10 years ago, the Environmental Protection Agency stepped in and set what's known as a pollution diet, or total maximum daily load, how much nitrogen, phosphorus, and other pollutants that you can put into the bay and still have the bay able to mitigate that pollution on its own. There were many efforts to do bay watershed agreements and joint efforts by all the states before this happened, and we can do an entire podcast on all of this later in life. But the important thing to realize is that this was pretty unprecedented. In fact, it took the Chesapeake Bay Foundation suing the Environmental Protection Agency, taking them to court and saying, hey, you guys aren't upholding the Clean Water Act. You need to start getting your shit together and maybe enforcing this. Get some teeth behind what you're saying. And once that happened, the total maximum daily load, these blueprints, whatever you want to call it, kind of set a path forward for how we could start reducing nitrogen and phosphorus, two really big problems that Chesapeake Bay has, as well as other pollutants. So through the past 10 years with this new plan, it has reduced nitrogen pollution by 23% and phosphorus pollution by 8%. It's a truly amazing thing to happen in just a decade. But it's also kind of important to realize that a lot of the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, are the ones that you do first. You know, the easy things like changing farming practices that don't require a lot of effort, you know, fencing cows out of streams and things like that. So still very impressive that all this happened. And these nutrients that typically they over-fertilize the bay, right? They're just providing too much. It's making huge algae blooms, and then they die and they pollute oxygen from the water. It all kind of is connected in that way. So the article is basically saying, through the reduction in all these nutrients, underwater grasses have just like taken off like crazy, and it's truly amazing, a recovery effort, pretty much the largest scale underwater grasses recovery in the world, and it's why the Chesapeake Bay is the best in the world. Now, since 1984, when we really started looking at underwater grasses in a systematic and scientific way, we've done yearly surveys, and since then, there's been a fourfold increase in submerged aquatic vegetation. So that's insane to think about, fourfold increase. And so that's why today's entire topic is just going to be diving into the history of submerged aquatic vegetation, the importance that it has to Chesapeake Bay, and further reasons why Chesapeake Bay is the best in the world. If you needed to encapsulate the entire 30 years of history that the penis study was referencing, this is kind of the number one quote that kind of stood out to me in the abstract, at least. That is, this success shows that coastal ecosystems are resilient and that concentrated efforts to reduce nutrient pollution can result in substantial improvements. I really am consistently impressed by this past decade when we just take a little bit of pressure off of it by reducing some pollution just by like a fourth, and already it has just rebounded in these amazing ways with clearer water, more grasses, healthier habitats, and crazy healthy populations of various species. So let's get right into SAVs. Here we go. Submerged aquatic vegetation, SAV, is literally just grasses that grow to the surface of but don't emerge from shallow water. And if you know anything about the bay, you know that it's pretty shallow. And like we mentioned last week, a fourth of the bay is 6 feet or less. So that is a lot of opportunity for sunlight to reach the bottom and get these grasses to grow. Think of these grasses as a refuge. They provide habitat for juvenile and adult fish and shellfish and protect them from predators. So the easiest equation I could ever give you is that more grasses equal more crabs. There is such a cause and effect relationship that you don't have to be a mathematician to figure out that equation. Literally every month, every couple of weeks, depending on the life cycle of a crab, they come out of their apron and their soft shell. So they have nothing at all to protect themselves from. They're super jelly-like and very soft. So anything and everything will eat them. And they need to hide. And the only place to really hide in the bay is in these grasses. So habitat is definitely the biggest reason why you should care about SAV. And they also provide food for waterfowl, fish, and mammals. A lot of things eat the grasses in order to survive. And if you ever think about up in Havre de Grace, there's this thing called the Susquehanna Flats. It's basically where the Susquehanna flows into the Chesapeake Bay. And historically, it was the best place to go waterfowl hunting in the country. Everyone from all over the country would come here. They'd stay at these resorts. It would be a huge economy boom for Maryland and even Pennsylvania, because all of the waterfowl that were coming from north to south in the winter months trying to escape all that cold were stopping over in Havre de Grace and these Susquehanna Flats, all of these underwater grasses, for all that food, all that nourishment on their way south. Definitely the best place to take these giant punt guns, these giant cannons, essentially, and just blast like 40 to 50 ducks or any other type of bird, like one shot in the late 1800s. It was insane how many ducks you would catch. Wait, question. Ducks, plural, or is it like deer and deers? You just say deer. I'm not sure. I'm going to research this. All right, I'm back. The plural form of duck is ducks, so I was right, guys. All right, some other reasons you should care about SAVs. They absorb wave energy, so you're not going to cause a lot of erosion when you have grasses right off of your beach or anything like that, because they're absorbing a lot of the waves before they have a chance to reach the shore. Just like oyster reefs do the same thing. They also produce oxygen. That's kind of an obvious, right? Especially in a time when we are struggling with dead zones in the bay and a lack of oxygen, it's really important to have plants that are literally putting oxygen into the water. And the last good reason to care about SAVs is because they will take a lot of the suspended sediment in the water and they'll stabilize the bottom sediment. So think of it just like a tree root keeping that sediment in place and not all over the place and in the water and clouding it all up. These grasses, they have to grow in shallow water, like we mentioned. They're rooted and their leaves don't allow them to float on the surface. Therefore, they're limited to waters that are shallow enough to allow that sunlight to reach them. They rarely get taller than 5 or 6 feet. They lack that like waxy cuticle that will keep terrestrial plants and upper surfaces, at least of floating plants, from like drying out. So they have to be submerged almost all the time. Otherwise, they'll just dry out and be totally gross and die. They have these really cool special air cells, though, that allow them to float upright in the water column. So if you ever go snorkeling or anything like that in some SAVs, it's almost like just a cool flowing forest of grasses just kind of fade back and forth with the waves. It truly is pretty beautiful. So what happened to these underwater grasses? Now, if you know this, Havre de Grace is longer the capital of shooting birds in the face. It has decimated the economy up there because there just aren't enough grasses to sustain that wildlife. And the underwater grasses have diminished for a lot of different reasons, but basically the number one reason is because of murky water. Think of really, really turbid water that sunlight is just not penetrating far enough. And we've already kind of talked about a few of those reasons One of them being that algae blooms are clouding up the water. They float on the surface. This plankton that is just growing really, really fast. And so that clouds the water up so the sunlight's not penetrating the bottom. But also, there's just a lot of sediment that goes into the water. There's a lot of dissolved sediment in the water from erosion, from crazy rainstorms that carries a lot of that sediment. And we have the infrastructure that doesn't really slow down that sediment from getting into the water. It just all comes in at once. So if you ever look at like satellite images of the Chesapeake Bay right after a big rain event, it completely changes the color of the entire bay. And you can kind of see all that sediment go from the tributaries or all the rivers around and slowly flush their way out into the bay. So as you get murkier and murkier water, you are limiting the habitat of these underwater grasses. If they used to be able to exist in like 10 feet of water, then now they can only exist in 6 feet. And then as it gets murkier and murkier, they can only exist in like 3 feet of water. There's just not enough sunlight penetrating to the bottom. To give you some context, when John Smith was here 400 years ago, he was observing about 20 feet clarity. You could see 20 feet down into the water. So don't get any ideas that the Chesapeake Bay used to be as crystal clear as the Caribbean or anything like that. It's always had a lot of nutrients and sediment in it. But 20 feet is significantly more than what we face today, which is routinely less than 5 feet of water clarity. So very important that we have that clarity for these underwater grasses. There has also been a recent rise in water temperatures, just a consequence of climate change. I'm not going to debate whether or not climate change is real. It's real. Whatever, it's happening. And that really poses a threat to eelgrass that is in like the upper reaches of the Chesapeake Bay. It's just not tolerant to warm temperatures. It needs colder water. And it grows as far north as the Arctic. So it can't prolong these really high water temperatures that are above 25 degrees Celsius, otherwise known as 77 degrees Fahrenheit. And the bay is really crazy in its temperature fluctuation. Like, as you might know, it freezes in the wintertime sometimes. And then in the summertime, you'll go swimming in August and it'll feel like lukewarm bathwater. So we're talking about a temperature fluctuation of below freezing, 30 degrees Fahrenheit, all the way to like 29 sometimes, and it going all the way up to in the 90 degree Fahrenheit range in August. So a lot of variability. And thus, eelgrass cannot sustain that prolonged period above 77 degrees Fahrenheit. They can take a little bit of it, but not months of it. So eelgrass is just one of the species of submerged aquatic vegetation. It's one of the big ones. A lot of animals rely on this particular grass for their food source. There's also wild celery and a few other, maybe about half dozen other major SAVs, but eelgrass is a pretty big one. Now, these underwater grasses started diminishing rapidly in the 60s and 70s. And a lot of organizations started trying to figure out what was happening. New nonprofits were formed during this time. People were like, oh my gosh, we got to do something. Things are not right. But really, all we knew at that time was that grasses were depleting. We didn't really know what the original amount of grasses there were in the bay before human impacts started depleting them. And so people started combing through aerial survey and photography to try to get an estimate on how many submerged grass beds there were growing in the bay. And the earliest thing we could really find was a 1937 aerial survey that people just looked at and kind of counted how many acres of grasses they could see from the sky in these black and white photos. And we found about 200,000 acres. So that kind of came the basis on, well, let's at least restore to this point. Let's at least try to get up to 200,000 and consider SAVs restored at that point. The Chesapeake Bay Program made it their goal. And while I am talking about Chesapeake Bay Program, I just want to give them a quick shout out because they truly are one of the most amazing programs in this country, perhaps even the world, as a partnership between so many different states, universities, government agencies that are all working to replenish the bay. So it is truly where I get a lot of my scientific research from. It's where I get a lot of my water quality data from. In fact, it's even where that study we were referencing earlier in the headlines, that scientific study on penis, I'll never forget, you're always going to be penis to me. They used the Chesapeake Bay Program's water quality data to analyze the SAV and kind of try to correlate the increase in water quality along with the decrease in nitrogen pollution and the resurgence of grasses. So they used that data to make those extrapolated connections. Let's move on. By the way, I've never worked for Chesapeake Bay Program, just really like them. So if 185,000 acres is the ultimate goal, then how many acres did we have when we were at our lowest? Well, in 1984, we only had about 37,000 acres of submerged aquatic vegetation in the entire bay. And then from 1984 to 2000, vegetation increased to 78,000 acres. That's a really rapid growth. But then the growth kind of just slowed to a stop for several years. But it is important to realize that there's a lot of year-to-year fluctuation and a lot of naturally occurring phenomena that happen when you're talking about SAV. For example, between 2002 and 2013, there was a really big decrease, and that's likely just because there's a lot of rain happening in the early growing season, the early spring, for like widgeon grass and these populations in the lower and mid-bay region. So there's a lot of decline in freshwater SAV species in the portion of the Potomac River and Susquehanna region, and that was all due to just it raining so much and so much sediment going into the water that it was just clouding it all up, and the grasses were really, really young and needed that clarity to grow, and it was just really bad timing. So you could kind of consider things like that happening, and then you had Hurricane Isabel happen in 2003, and there's another decline that happened in 2005, 2006 that was likely because of above average water temperatures, and then there's a dry spring and the early summer rain event in 2006. 2011, 2012 had declines due to dieback of eelgrass because an extremely hot summer. The way Chesapeake Bay Program and a lot of other partners approach this grass restoration was four different facets. One, and the most important one, is improving water clarity, because even if you plant underwater grasses and protect existing grass beds, they're not going to thrive unless you have clear enough water for those plants to get sunlight in the first place. So that became the priority. Secondly, we tried to protect existing grass beds. And I love how I consistently say we, like I'm actively doing pretty much as an educator. But, you know, I've planted some grasses. You don't know my life. And then we have tried to identify, or modern scientists have, where there is key areas that grasses once grew, historically grew, that we target to do some underwater grass planting. So that is a component, although very much a lesser component than trying to systematically improve water clarity. And I'm not going to get into how we systematically improve water clarity, because that would be like a 3-hour podcast. Just know, you know, it's a good thing to improve water clarity, and we're working on it. To improve water clarity, you need less sediment entering the bay. To get less sediment entering the bay, you need to have more riparian buffers, things grown along the borders of land and water, stop that sediment from getting into the bay. So we're talking rain gardens and trying to decrease erosion by various measures. And then the very last way that we have tried to protect and enhance underwater grass beds is through education and outreach. Yeah, that's me. That's what I'm doing right now with you. And I'm not even getting paid to do this. But the reason this is an important key is because in the 60s, before grasses started getting so rapidly depleted, people thought of grass beds as a nuisance, as a weed. It would get stuck in boats, like in the impellers and in the props, and totally ruin people's boats. They would be like, ew, it's seaweed and touch my leg. Not cool. Even the government in the 60s was like, oh, these are such a nuisance, that there's been reports of the government in Habitat of Grace actually like throwing this random white chemical in the water to purposely kill the underwater grasses. It's been unconfirmed, but you know, whatever. If you want to believe in conspiracy theories, I'm sure we weren't that excited about having underwater grasses until we realized their importance. Okay, now I'm going to share some statistics about what has been happening recently in like 2014, 2015, as far as underwater grass populations. This is a really important step for me because it is basically my redemption from a newspaper article that I was quoted in and written about a year ago. So I made a mistake in that article, and I don't want to reference what it is because then you're going to figure out what my job is too. But I basically said that between 2014 and 2015, baygrass has suddenly increased in 91,000 acres, which is true. But then I was like directly quoted as saying this. I said, which is like a 22% increase in a year. And I was just speaking off the spot, you know, not really good at math on the spot. And basically, I'm not right when I say 22% increase. It's actually only like a 16.6% increase, but still impressive. So anyway, I look at that article in pure shame. But now I have redeemed myself, only a 16.6% increase. But that's in a year. That's insane. And to give you some context, the 2017 goal was to have 90,000 acres total in the Chesapeake Bay. And by 2015, we had 91,000 acres. So we exceeded that goal. You know how rare that is in the environmental field to exceed a goal? Oh, never happens. Cherish this. Cherish this forever. And then in 2016, we 7,000 acres. So even a year before 2017, still kicking ass. The next milestone we're aiming for is 2025. And by that time period, we should have, if all things go right, 130,000 acres. So we're making great progress on this. It's impressive how fast they've grown. It's even been impressive enough for the Washington Post to try to take some journalism from me and say how awesome Sweet Bay is. We all know this if you listened to last week's episode. And we are already at 53% of the 185,000 ultimate goal that Chesapeake Bay program set. So, boom, topic complete. I think at this point you know how important SAVs are to the Chesapeake Bay. You know why they declined. You know what we're doing to restore them. And you know that we're on the right track. So, I think you know what this calls for. Whew, another topic down. Thank you guys for tuning in. I had a great time, and I'm sorry this one went long. I really need to try to cap this at 15 minutes because it's just too much going on for one episode. But I hope you learned something. I hope you tune in next week, or rather not next week because I'm going to try to do these bi-weekly. Just don't have enough time. And if you appreciated this, go ahead and leave me a review. I'm trying to get as many as 100 people listening to the next episode. And I'm already impressed that I did no advertising whatsoever, and 37 of you found me, so that's really awesome. I hope that you're really into learning more about Chesapeake Bay. I'm going to take a little break from doing science-related topics, and next time I do this, I'm going to talk more about the culture and the waterman history of skipjacks. We're going to dive all into the state boat of Maryland, the skipjack. All right. Thank you, guys. And I will send you off. Oh, by the way, Dim Eastport Oyster Boys, that was a song in the intro. If you want to stay tuned, I'll play the entire song for you as this credit rolls. And I really encourage you, if you like their music, to look them up further. They're on YouTube. They're available to play parties. Mainly, I'm just trying to pitch them because I feel really bad about using their music without even really telling them. So thank you, Dim Eastport Oyster Boys, for being such an awesome band. And they've played many events that I've been at that I really know how to rock the stage. All right. Thank you, guys.
The baby boomer generation has fostered overpopulation, waterfront property inflation, development deforestation. Deforestation leads to soil erosion that wreaks environmental devastation on subaquatic vegetation. SAVs.
Subaquatic vegetation.
SAVs.
Subaquatic vegetation.
SAVs.
Subaquatic vegetation.
SAVs.
Subaquatic vegetation.
You comprehend the complications. Erosion brings about siltation, which covers up the vegetation, creating sunlight deprivation. Muddies the water till the plants must desist their photosynthesis. Yes, it's a cause for consternation for subaquatic vegetation. SAV.
Subaquatic vegetation.
SAV.
Subaquatic vegetation.
SAV.
Subaquatic vegetation.
SAV.
Subaquatic vegetation.
Now listen for your information. It's not a hopeless situation. We must act without hesitation, enforcing soil conservation. Instead of tearing down our trees, we must need to plant some seeds. The subaquatic vegetation can be saved by reforestation. save.
Subaquatic vegetation.
Save.
Subaquatic vegetation.
Save.
Subaquatic vegetation.
It's not a tricky operation. Engaging in reforestation. Just make a little excavation and stick a sprout of vegetation in. Planting a little tree can be the solution to runoff pollution. It can be the one salvation for subaquatic vegetation. Save.
Subaquatic vegetation.
Save.
Subaquatic vegetation.
Save.
Subaquatic vegetation.
Save. Let's hear an ovation.
Subaquatic vegetation.
For subaquatic vegetation.
Subaquatic vegetation.
All right, welcome to the post-episode secret spot, where every week I share a Chesapeake-related meme. And because there aren't that many Chesapeake Bay-related memes, as in not really any at all, a lot of them are of my own creation, and I really like to describe what is pretty much an impossible context of an internet meme and try to do it over the airwaves. It makes no sense. So. That's half the fun. And today's meme of the week, you can find it over at my Twitter page at Burt Baywide. And it is basically, you know, the Arthur cartoon where they have the zoom in of his fist and it's always like, oh, I'm really angry about this, or like when blah, blah, blah does blah, blah, blah. So it's going to be a picture of that fist, and then it's going to have the caption, which will say, when San Franciscans say Bay Area.